Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Eric Klein, attorney registration number 42185, and I represent Mr. Guzman in this criminal appeal. As Judge Connolly noted in his concurrence and dissent in Orem, the Supreme Court of the United States has previously stated, under our criminal justice system, even a thief is entitled to complain that he has been unconstitutionally convicted and imprisoned as a burglar. In this case, the evidence supported a finding that Mr. Guzman may have been a thief, but not a burglar. There was insufficient evidence for a finding that Mr. Guzman committed second-degree burglary, and that conviction was a denial of due process. Your Honor, this was a case about a young man who went along for a ride with his two young friends who went to get their money back for a defective Xbox game system that they had bought. And in the fast-moving chain of events, once the young man arrived at the home of the person who had sold the Xbox, Mr. Guzman may have gotten swept up. But the evidence does not support a finding that he had the intent to steal at the time that he entered the home. He may have been guilty of misdemeanors of criminal trespass, theft, and criminal mischief, but not burglary. Your Honor, in this...
Counsel, can I ask you a question?
Yes. I don't know if your microphone's on.
Is that working?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Different mics. Couldn't the jury reasonably have inferred an intent to steal at the time of the entry, given the facts that it's undisputed that they went back there to get the $20 back, and then when they broke down the door, couldn't the jury have inferred that they were prepared, since that was an unlawful act, couldn't the jury have inferred that it was the intention of defendant to get the $20 back one way or another, even if that included having to take the money off the person of the seller of the box or to take something else?
You know, I think Your Honor's use of the pronoun they actually is very telling, because I think that actually ties into the complicity issue. I think that there may have been a fair inference that the brothers, the Vallis brothers, who went to get their $20 back, may have had that intention at the time that they entered. But in the absence of evidence of Mr. Guzman's intent, I don't think the evidence can support such a finding, and that such a finding would cross that impermissible line from inference to conjecture or speculation. Here, there is no evidence whatsoever of Mr. Guzman's intent. There's no statement from Mr. Guzman. There's no indication from Mr. Guzman of his intent prior to exiting the home with shoes and the father.
Excuse me, but it's unusual for someone to express their intent under these circumstances. So isn't it normally based on circumstantial evidence and inferences drawn from the actual evidence presented to the jury?
Oh, I think, Your Honor, I think it's a juxtaposition with the Mandez case that the government cites actually is very telling. There, this court found that the inferences could be drawn, and the court specifically pointed out the fact that there it was a breaking entering at night through a basement window, that there was kind of a blood trail of footprints indicating that there had been a thorough search of the home for items to steal. Here there is the middle of the day, knocking on the door of an occupied home, knocking leading to pounding that eventually led to bursting through the door. That's very different. I submit that the inference can't be drawn that their intent necessarily was to steal at the time of the entry, as opposed to continue with all the stated intent. All the evidence was the stated intent was to try to negotiate or come to some agreement to get the $20 back for the Xbox.
Does it seem, couldn't a jury reasonably conclude once the defendant broke down the door, and I think the evidence is that he either did it by himself or with another person, that doesn't it seem unlikely that if the seller said, no, I'm not going to return the $20, that they would quietly leave. Once they broke down the door, didn't that show Mr. Guzman having an intention, and it was Mr. Guzman who was involved in breaking into the door, that had an intention to get the money back one way or another?
Yeah, I think that, again, that would be crossing the line from inference to conjecture. I think there may be an inference, maybe, and I don't want to necessarily commit to this, that there was going to be even a beating administered for the selling of the defective Xbox. But there's no indication of what the purpose was other than confronting. I think a fair inference would be And I think that the most that can be inferred is an intention to confront the seller of the defective Xbox at that time because he was evading answering for selling this defective Xbox. As to the brothers who were actually, in their words, ripped off for the money, there may have been a fair inference that they intended to get that money back. But Mr. Guzman had no stake in this. It wasn't his $20. As I believe it was Mario Vallis testified, it was just through happenstance that he went along for this ride. There's no indication of Mr. Guzman's intent at the moment of the entry.
Counsel, how do you address the fact that at least three Court of Appeals cases, Orem, Larkins, and Martina, have concluded that the intent to steal does not have to exist at the time of entry? And couldn't a jury reasonably conclude that that intent was formed sometime before he left, given that there was testimony that he left with something more than what he came in with? If you could address that.
Your Honor, this jury could not conclude that because this jury was never instructed on a theory of unlawful remaining. And so, Your Honor, in the first instance, I submit that, Orem and Larkins and those cases are not applicable here because this jury was specifically instructed only on unlawfully breaking and entering. The prosecution argued only unlawful breaking and entering. Here, this jury, and I submit that is what this court has to review, whether this jury's verdict can be supported by the evidence. This jury could not have made an inference about an unlawful remaining because the words unlawful remaining were never uttered in this case, and this jury was never instructed on that theory. You know, obviously, I spent some time in our reply brief also arguing about why this court should not follow those cases and why those cases could lead to a parade of horribles, but I submit in the first instance, there's no basis for this court to uphold a verdict on such a theory because that simply was not presented to this jury.
And it's you're not here denying the evidence that he took sneakers out of the apartment that he did not own.
The standard is that the court must view the evidence in the light most favorable to the government. I don't think I can argue that with any credibility. There was testimony that Mr. Guzman had the sneakers. There was testimony that the sneakers belonged to one of the occupants of the home. I don't think I have any basis to argue against what the court states.
But as I understand your argument, there is not enough evidence upon which a reasonable juror could conclude that your client broke the door in and that when he did that, his intention was to do something illegal inside.
I think there was sufficient evidence to support a conviction for criminal mischief for breaking the door. There was testimony that either Mr. Guzman did that or that he did it in conjunction with one of the other young men. The question is whether there was sufficient evidence that at the moment of the breaking, he had the intent to steal, and I submit that there is insufficient evidence, even drawing all reasonable inferences in favor of light most favorable to the prosecution.
Thank you.
And Your Honor, I would like to discuss the complicity instruction, and I will begin with a large mea culpa, because hopefully the court received my notice of errata, and my opening brief and my reply treated the instruction that was given as if it was the instruction given under the old pattern instruction in Bogdanov. Obviously, the instruction that was actually given here was very different because it omitted the crucial word from the fourth element of the old pattern instruction intentionally. And that does take this out of the realm of Bogdanov and Close in those cases. And that is exactly what the prosecution argued to the jury in this case, was that knowledge plus action is enough to be convicted under complicity theory. And that is exactly what the instruction erroneously told the jury, was that knowledge that the principal intended to commit a crime and an action, aiding and abetting, without any sort of mens rea attached to it, was sufficient. And in this case, as I was pointing out with Judge Miller, this is a case where the jury easily could have found that the Vallis brothers, the ones who had the incentive to obtain their money back, did enter with an intent to steal. And there would be sufficient evidence that Mr. Guzman knew that they intended to commit some crime therein when going into the home. and that Mr. Guzman, by breaking the door, assisted them, aided and abetted them in entering the home. But without that instruction that Mr. Guzman have that requisite mens rea at the time, that he was intentionally aiding and abetting the furtherance of the crime, this instruction I submit is plain error.
What's the standard of review on the on this issue?
Your Honor, it's a plain error review, and as the Colorado Supreme Court has held in Allman, I hope I pronounced that case correctly, the question is whether a reasonable possibility exists that the erroneous instruction contributed to Mr. Guzman's conviction such that serious doubt is cast upon the reliability of the jury's verdict. And in this case, this jury, while deliberating, gave only one indication of anything going on in its collective mind, and that was about complicity. The jury sent out a single inquiry, and that was about the definition of complicity and how it applies to these charges. And that inquiry was never answered because they came upon the erroneous instruction. But as far as this court can have insight into how the jury was thinking, that is all that the court can know. And I submit that that does call into question and cast serious doubt upon the reliability of the jury's verdict in this case.
How do you respond to the people's argument that Mr. Guzman's defense, hey, that was an alibi? He says he wasn't even there at the time. So how could this constitute harmless error since the jury obviously rejected the alibi?
Your Honor, I think that by putting on a defensive alibi, all issues are put in at issue. All issues are contested. Obviously, the jury did not agree with Mr. Guzman's theory, but this was still an issue for this jury. And I submit that this court, in viewing the impact of the jury instructions, should look more at what was concerning this jury. In Allman, the Supreme Court, in discussing about whether an issue is contested, talked about if there existed an evidentiary dispute about the issue. And I submit here there is an evidentiary dispute, and the jury itself focused on that evidentiary dispute, and the prosecution focused on that evidentiary dispute by turning the jury's attention specifically to the complicity instruction in its closing argument and arguing consistent with the erroneous complicity instruction that all the jury needed to find was knowledge and an action of aiding and abetting. I have 2.5 minutes left, and I would ask to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Then you may do so.
Thank you.
Ms. Rohrbaugh.
May it please the court, counsel, assembled students. My name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. I'd like to begin with two observations. The first is I feel a bit as though I've been subjected to trying to hit a moving target in this case, because it's axiomatic that this court doesn't address issues that are raised for the first time in a reply brief, let alone on the eve of argument. So I'm somewhat concerned that there are very specific arguments that have been made about the wording of the jury instructions that were not raised in the opening brief. My second observation I'd like to make.
I think you're referring to the errata that was distributed?
Yeah, Your Honor, I'm referring to both the errata that was distributed on Friday at about noon. I'm also referring to the fact that with regard to the first issue, the way that the jury was actually instructed in the burglary instruction was raised for the first time in the reply brief. The opening brief argued that based upon the Cooper case, the defendant could not have had the after entry intention.
As far as the instruction goes, is there any dispute that the instruction that was actually given to the jury is as ultimately explained in the errata?
No, Your Honor, there's no dispute as to the instruction.
Do you have further information to share with the court concerning what's in the errata? I mean, we'd like to give you that opportunity if you need it.
Your Honor, I have two observations with regard to the errata. The first is, as I just said, that this court only addresses issues that are raised in the opening brief. And as I understand it, the argument is different in the errata. The second observation I have to make is with regard to this complicity jury instruction, which is that it's the people's position that the defendant at trial only contested the issue of identity. And I could cite some cases for the proposition that where only identity is contested at trial, that in fact there is no plain error with regard to instructions on other items in the jury instruction.
And there's no question here that the defense had an opportunity to object to the jury instruction and they did not?
That's correct. There was no objection to the jury instructions.
Ms. Brock, would you stop the time for a minute here? There's been several references to errata. And Mr. Klein, why don't you tell the students what precisely the errata was that you brought our attention to?
For those who have read the briefs, you will see that we don't agree regarding the implicit instruction and set out implicit instruction in the opening brief. In preparing for oral argument, I discovered that I misprinted the instruction that actually was given to the jury. It was accurately reproduced in the government's answer brief, and then it left out the word intentionally in the fourth element as giving the jury implicit. And so I filed a notice on Friday.
Thank you.
My other observation that I wanted to make is, of course, that the defense at trial was alibi. And as I said, my position is that by raising such a defense, what was being contested was the identity of the perpetrator, which is pretty much the first element of any jury instruction. With that, I'll move on to the evidence supporting the defendant's burglary conviction.
Well, Ms. Rohrbaugh, before you do that, would you like an opportunity to file something in response to the filing of the errata?
Your Honor, what I would tell you, I can tell you orally, and that might get rid of having to actually file something in writing. I don't have, off the top of my head, the cite for the case that says that you cannot bring up a new argument in the reply brief, but it's a case something like Sejerminski, and I think the court is familiar with that principle. With regard to the issue of merely identity not being contested and thus there being no plain error, I had looked at the Dunlap case, which is 124 P3rd 780. It's a 2004 Court of Appeals case. And in that case, on page 794 and 795, there is a cite of three cases. Espinoza v. People, 712 P. 2nd at 478. People v. Huggins, 825 P. 2nd at 1024. And People v. Esquivel, 794 P. 2nd, 1065. All of those cases stand for the proposition that there is no plain error where the defendant's defense goes purely to identity. Now, when we look at the government's evidence in this case, we have the brothers, MV and OV, who testified for the prosecution. So we have that as part of the people's case, as well as their father's testimony. We had the testimony of a detective that the victim, CV, had said that he recognized the defendant as the third individual he had seen at the front door. Now, CV denied this at trial, but we have the detective's testimony that, in fact, he was recognized, and this goes to the defendant's identity. MV testified that the defendant was the individual who broke down the door. OV testified that the defendant and the juvenile co-defendant, JH, had done so. So we clearly have witnesses who identify the defendant as the person who broke down the door. Then subsequently, MV and OV testified that the defendant and the juvenile co-defendant had taken some jewelry, a camera, and a pair of shoes from the home. Furthermore, after the defendant came back to the car, the father of MV and OV testified the defendant had said that he had gone into the apartment and grabbed the shoes. So clearly, based upon even statements attributed to the defendant, he went into the apartment and stole the shoes. And I think we look at this under the totality of the circumstances in the light most favorable to the prosecution. And I think we can infer from this evidence that there was the intent to steal something of value. Now, I don't believe that it had to be that he knew he was going to take the sneakers when he was in the apartment. It only had to be within the language of the theft instruction that he wanted to take something of value. I'd also like to note, with regard to the evidence presented at trial, briefly, that I don't think there was any evidence presented at trial that the brothers had entered the apartment. I think the evidence that we had, which was the evidence of the brothers, was that they had not entered the apartment. They had stayed outside after the knocking was done. And it was the defendant and the juvenile co-defendant who had entered the apartment. Now, when we move on to the issue, as I will, unless this court has further questions about sufficiency, when we move on to the issue of plain error in the jury instruction, what I understood to be the defendant's argument from the opening brief was that the jury instruction was erroneous and should the case should be reversed because it did not track the language that was suggested in the Bogdanov case. And I agreed that it was true that this did not have the suggested language in the Bogdanov case. But I argued that the Bogdanov case said that, in fact, the language of the existing instruction adequately gave the jury the elements of complicity. And so the defendant has made a different argument, as I understand it, in his notice of errata. And his argument in his notice of errata is that the instruction that was given is missing the word intentionally. And so I'm going to address the merits of this argument, although I'm not sure that it's properly before this court. Here, there was no intentionally in this element in the instruction. That is true. And it may be that this constitutes, because there are three levels or a couple of parts of the plain error analysis. One is that it has to be plain or obvious error. It also has to affect the substantial rights of the defendant. And for plain error, it has to render his trial unfair. And this does not happen where the element has not been contested at trial. So if we look at this and if we say that this was plain or obvious error for the sake of argument, that the trial court should have recognized that the intentionally should have been in the instruction, there is still the burden to show that it affected the defendant's substantial rights. And here I think it's substantially different from the Aumann case, because if you read the Aumann decision, it's very clear that Aumann's attorneys argued that in fact she did not have the intent to break into her sometime boyfriend's room to steal his belongings, but only to take back her own belongings. This was an argument that was actually made to the jury at trial. Now, I want to be very clear that the instruction which was erroneous was the theft instruction in the Aumann case. So it involved a different instruction altogether. It was not a complicity instruction case, but it's clear that that was a contested element in that case. The element was contested about whether she was authorized to make an entry and whether she did so with the intent to commit theft. Here we have a situation where the complicity was not contested by the defense. The defense argument was solely that the defendant had not been present at the scene, that he had an alibi, that he'd been and met a friend at a fast food restaurant at the time that the burglary took place. Now, there were, of course, some problems with the alibi defense because the break-in took place at about noon, and at the time that the alibi witness was questioned by the police, he said that they met at 2 p.m., which was well after the break-in had occurred. But at trial, he testified that he met the defendant at the fast food restaurant at noon, which constituted the defendant's alibi. And it's the people's position that an alibi defense goes, as I said, simply to the element of identity and not to the complicity.
Well, counsel doesn't, by saying, gee, I wasn't there at the time, so I couldn't have done it, doesn't that encompass the notion, therefore I didn't intend to do it because I wasn't there and I didn't do it?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that it challenges that the crimes were committed. It only challenges the who committed the crimes, not that the crimes were committed.
But doesn't it also assert that I did not break in the door and thus I did not have the intention of doing anything at the time?
Your Honor, I don't think so. I think that it's solely to identity, and it didn't dispute that someone broke in the door and someone stole the shoes. His argument was that he was not that someone.
Well, necessarily, if someone else broke in the door and someone else stole the shoes, I certainly didn't have any intention to do any of those things. And isn't that what the issue is? Is what is the intent? What was the defendant's intention at the time?
Your Honor, I think that for purposes of the jury instruction and what was contested, if you look at the defense argument was not that the defendant's behavior did not intentionally aid and abet the co-defendant's behavior. The argument was that he didn't do it, he wasn't there. So I don't think that that element of the complicity was really at issue. I think the question that the jury asked here is not important at all, because the jury asked about the definition of complicity. At the time, the counsel and the judge then wrote an answer which directed the jury back to the complicity instruction, which was instruction 14. Before they delivered that answer to the jury sent another message back saying essentially, oh, by the way, we found instruction 14. So it wasn't that they were confused by instruction 14. It was that they simply hadn't found it in the packet of instructions. So I think that doesn't play into the question of the plain error for the instruction.
And couldn't that question by the jury have been an additional opportunity to alert defendant's attorney to take a second look at the instruction and determine whether it was missing any information, as is now claimed?
Yes, absolutely. Under the plain error standard of review, that would have been an additional opportunity for defense counsel to have said, hey, wait, I just looked at this instruction and it needs another word. So that would have been an opportunity for the defense to have done that, and it was not done. When we look at complicity liability, obviously it's the knowledge that the crime is going to be committed and the intent to aid and abet. If we look at the evidence, we have a situation where both J.H., the co-defendant, and the defendant here could be guilty either as principals or as complicitors, because either the defendant or the defendant and the co-defendant broke down the door. They both took some property from the home. The defendant took the shoes. The co-defendant apparently took the jewelry items, which were later pawned by the brother's father. So both of them, under the facts presented, one or both of them broke in the door, but the defendant was one of those, and then both of them took the items from inside the home. I thank the court for this time and attention. I see that I'm now out of time, so I'd ask you to affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you. Mr. Klein, you have about 2.5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd first just like to address briefly the allegation that there's some sort of moving target here as far as what's been raised in our reply brief. Our reply brief on sufficiency was directly responsive to the government's argument in its answer brief that the Cooper case did not control. This court has stated since Orem and Larkins and since the change of the statute that in such a situation as this trial, that Cooper still controls. In Fuentes, which we cite in our reply brief, the court said the intent to commit a crime must be present at the very moment that the person trespasses, and cites Cooper. Court goes on, if the trespass is based on unlawful entry, the crime therefore turns not on the commission of other acts once inside, but on the person's entry with the requisite intent at the time of that entry. So therefore, even after the change of the statute, even after Larkins and Orem, that where the theory of prosecution is unlawful entry, as it was in this case, Cooper still controls. Your Honor, alibi, I submit, as Judge Carparelli and Judge Miller pointed out, does put everything at issue, including complicity. But I submit that on a more fundamental level for due process concerns. The cases that talk about for plain error where an issue is not contested are cases where there's no indication that that issue was a part of the case at all. There are not cases where there's a jury instruction specifically asking about an issue, and it just cannot be that if a jury indicates a focus on a theory of liability that consistent with due process, that because a defense lawyer made a strategic decision, a tactical decision, not to pursue a theory of defense, that therefore there can never be plain error. Because here the jury focused on that, and the jury showed that it had concerns about complicity. And Judge Fox, it seems that you are raising concerns that defense counsel had every opportunity here to address this, and I submit that it also can't be because potentially there was ineffective assistance of counsel that there can never be plain error. The question for this court is, did the trial court have an obligation to correct the error? And here, where the instruction was so inaccurate, I submit that the trial court did have an obligation to correct that error. And as I am out of time, I will ask the court to reverse the convictions as we've requested.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Thank you, counsel. The arguments were excellent and will be helpful to us as we deliberate. The case of People against Guzman now stands submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course. Thank you again.